Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hi, I'm Zach Crouch, and you're listening to Landmark Recovery Radio, your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. You can find us online wherever you get your podcasts, and please don't forget to subscribe to get the most up-to-date information from leading experts. We have guest Richard Osnes joining us on the show today. Richard is a University of Research professor and Stites and Harbison Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky's J. David Rosenberg College of Law. He's been on staff at the university since 1973, and he's also a member of the Florida Bar, and he's published several books, more than 70 law review articles as well. Professor Osnes is currently examining the opioid litigation phenomenon. Richard, it is a pleasure to have you on the show with us today. This is a wonderful topic. I'm sure that it'll generate a lot of feedback from our listeners, and I'm looking forward to diving into the subject.
Thank you, Zach.
So just off the bat, I'm curious, you're examining this opioid litigation phenomenon. Tell us a little bit more what that actually means. What is the phenomenon behind this?
Well, it's similar to a number of cases that have occurred over the last 30 or 40 years involving the tort claims against mostly product manufacturers, such as tobacco, asbestos, handguns, and lead paint. The one thing about this that I think perhaps makes it a little different is the scale. There are well over 2,500 plaintiffs, state and local governments, and quite a number of opioid companies as defendants as well. So there are just an awful lot of players in this, and the stakes are quite high. If there is ever a settlement, and I don't know if there will be or not, it will be many billions of dollars because, of course, the opioid epidemic has been extremely costly, both economically and in terms of ruined lives.
So among these plaintiffs that are coming forward, are these just people coming from all walks of life?
Well, no, actually, most of the litigation involves governmental entities, states, counties, and municipalities. There were earlier a number of personal injury cases by individuals, but they didn't fare very well. I did a piece on that about 12, 13 years ago. And really from about the year 2000 until maybe 2010, opioid company, and they were mostly brought against Purdue Pharma, and Purdue pretty much won all of those cases. And I think it was because the victims were not, all that sympathetic, and the pharmaceutical companies, Purdue in particular, were able to sort of typecast them as criminals people who had only themselves to blame for their condition. That was, of course, terribly unfair, but it did seem to resonate with the courts. Most of the cases were dismissed. Now, one thing that might happen based on the experience with tobacco is the very same thing happened with individual claimants in the tobacco litigation. But once the litigation heated up and the government got involved, mostly states, a lot of dirt came out, and all of a sudden the smokers didn't look so bad because of the manipulating the nicotine and whatnot. So the same thing may happen. We may get a whole bunch of individual cases as well. And there are some class actions involving individuals, but I haven't really followed those all that closely.
Can you tell our listeners, obviously I'm not a law guy. I mean, I know a little bit about the legal system, but what constitutes a class action?
Well, what a class action is it's a way of consolidating a whole lot of similar cases, and it makes it far more economical because you'll have only one trial instead of perhaps thousands. So you only do it once. You don't relitigate the same issues time and time again. From the plaintiff's point of view, allows them to sort of engage in economies of scale. They can band together and hire experts, and it just makes financing a trial much more reasonable for them. And from the defendant's point of view, at least sometimes they like the idea of rolling the dice once and getting a decision. Now, having said that, a lot of class actions, probably most of them, if they get that far, will be settled. Because when push comes to shove, neither side really wants to risk a trial.
Got it. So among these 2,500 plaintiffs that you noted, in most of them are government entities, et cetera. What are they claiming against these companies? What are the states claiming? What are their basis on these lawsuits?
Before we even get into that, I should mention that there are actually several tracks. The case that I alluded to is what's in multi-district litigation, and there are a bunch of individual lawsuits that are pretrial work is done in one court. They're all transferred to a single court, and then they do the pretrial stuff, discovery and things of that sort. But there's another track that's going on as well, actually two other tracks. The states are not subject to this. In other words, these were actions that were probably brought in state court by municipalities and counties, and the defendants got them transferred into federal court. Once they got transferred into a federal court, they were subject to this further transfer under this multi-district litigation process. On the other hand, the states are not subject to that because they're sovereign entities. And so those cases are being tried in state courts, which, of course, are much more friendly. Mm-hmm. And only one has actually gone to trial, and that was in Oklahoma. And there was a very large judgment. It was over $1 billion. So on top of that, there's a Purdue filed for bankruptcy. So its case is being handled by a bankruptcy court. So you've got sort of three tracks going on. As far as the legal theories, I won't get into that too deeply, but public nuisance seems to be the favorite. There are some others too, but they're basically arguing, the plaintiffs that is, that the marketing, particularly the marketing activities, were fraudulent, created a public nuisance, namely the opioid epidemic. And what they're seeking, what the plaintiffs are seeking generally are the cost of abating the nuisance, meaning treatment programs and things of that sort, which can, of course, be rightfully expensive.
Sure, absolutely. You're obviously in the middle of all this. Do you have an opinion either way about the marketing tactics that have been brought forward from these large companies?
Well, there's no doubt that the marketing practices were unethical and in some cases illegal. They basically what they did was persuade doctors that opioids could be used to treat chronic pain, even though historically they'd only been used for short-term treatments, end-of-life types of situations. Right. And they misrepresented the effectiveness of opioids for this purpose, and they downplayed the risks of addiction. And so as a consequence, doctors overprescribed opioids or prescribed them for minor pain when better treatments were available. And what we ended up with was thousands of people who are addicted, and all of the consequences of that. But that doesn't mean they're liable. There are lots of other issues that they presumably could raise that might get them off the hook.
If I remember,
which is
I was going to say, Richard, I remember one thing that sticks out in my mind is I think Purdue used it. It was something that was published, and maybe it might have been in JAMA, but it wasn't even like a full-fledged research article, meaning that there wasn't really any scientific rigor behind the study. I don't even know if it was a study, but there wasn't any replication of the results. But they published this study or research article, and I think that they used a lot of that to make the case to these, you know, whether it was PCP doctors, et cetera, to use their product. Do you remember that?
I do, and you're exactly right. There were several instances of that, but what the problem with doing that was that the research was mostly short term, and so right. Obviously the addictive issue was more associated with longer term usage, but they didn't tell the doctors that they were promoting the drug to, and so that. That was certainly one particularly egregious example of misrepresentation, but there were many others too. For example, they pretty much invented a concept called pseudo-addiction, meaning that if you showed signs of addiction, you needed more opioids, not less. And there was just no scientific foundation for that at all. So it was that kind of stuff. I might add, this is not the only instance of that. The drug companies have engaged in these phony publications to promote all sorts of drugs, not just opioids.
Well, I'm going to ask a question here too. I'm curious to hear from your perspective. Just when, because this was the early 90s, I think, right? When Purdue was really making the big push.
Around 1996.
Back then, and even today for that matter, what responsibility do you think medical professionals should have had to bear some of the responsibility about addiction, and that this really truly was something that could have caused long-term addictive qualities?
Well, you would think they would realize that opioids are addictive. I mean, we were told that when I was in fifth grade. So you would think professionals would be aware of that or very cautious about prescribing opioids. But the drug companies were very persuasive, and they tended to target doctors who were not familiar with or didn't use opioids in their practice very much. So they believed what the sales representatives told them. Perhaps they should have been a little more diligent. And then, of course, there were a big part of the problem were pill mills and doctors who were just overprescribing consciously, that was a big part of the problem too. And a number of them went to jail. The federal government convicted them of criminal misconduct.
Well, and also, Richard, a lot's happened in the 25, 30 years since that, where it's now, I don't know if it was the Stark laws that prohibited this, but basically you as a provider, as a medical provider, you know, physician, PA, whoever, cannot take gifts and things like that from pharmaceutical companies. Did a large part of that push happen due to Purdue Pharma as an example?
Definitely. All of the companies did that. And again, not just with opioids, right, but with any kind of prescription drugs. One of the most recent example was Subsys, I believe was the name of the company. And they made an opioid product, and they completely bribed doctors. I mean, it was a huge scandal, and they eventually went to prison. Well, they're about to go to prison, not those, but they put it that way. They were convicted up in New York. So there's a lot of that that goes on, and I think the drug companies are a little more subtle about it now, but they clearly, it isn't just outright sort of garden variety stuff that they do. They're sometimes more sophisticated, and they pay, in quotation marks, doctors to put on CLE, continual medical education. Yeah, and they don't actually do it, or they give a 5-minute speech and get $10,000. Also, they create testing post approval testing things that they pay the doctors per patient to submit to it, and of course they're never going to actually do anything with the tests, but it's a way of again encouraging the doctors to prescribe their products.
Sure. I want to come back to these settlements, and I'm curious to know, how do they come to the courts? How do they come to the correct dollar amount in these large settlements?
Well, I don't know if correct would be the right way to describe it. It's right. A bargaining process, and it's the outer limit is what the defendants are willing to pay or what they can pay. So if we say hypothetically the opioid problem is $100 billion a year, which I think is probably on the low side, the drug companies only have $20 billion. That's all they're going to, that's all they can pay. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of back and forth that goes on. Now, whether or not there will be a settlement remains to be seen, because as I say, there's so many players. If you go back to the tobacco settlement, which is sort of the model for all of these other settlement negotiations, there were only, I think, 6 tobacco companies and 50 states. So, the numbers weren't that bad. And they were able to get together and work out something. Here you've got, you not only have 2,500 local governments and 50 state governments, but there are about 25,000 other ones who have not sued yet but could. So that makes it extremely difficult to settle. Now, what they have done is create a class action or a class, a settlement class, and assuming that is valid, every local government would be, unless they opt out, would be bound by the settlement if one is negotiated. And it's a little more complicated than that, but that's basically designed to get the defendants to actually agree to something, because why would they want to agree to a multi-billion-dollar settlement if 90% of the potential plaintiffs are not even in the case?
Right.
But as far as getting the right amount, That's as I say, I think it's more a matter of negotiation than it. Now, obviously, they'll have economists and others providing some evidence of what it should be. But who knows what it is? It's now I will say in Connecticut, this is not a settlement situation, but it's somewhat similar. The Oklahoma case I spoke of, the state came up with an abatement plan. And they priced everything out. So the court just said, yeah, that sounds good to us. And the amount was over almost $1 billion. So it was for, a relatively small state. That's a lot of money.
That is.
If the remedy is abatement and what it will cost, at least for 1 year, to essentially create treatment programs and other programs of that sort, then you can at least get a handle on what the upper limit ought to be. But in a negotiation or where you don't have the amount calculated by the court, then it's there's going to be some give and take. And it's, as I say, it boils down to what the drug companies can pay. What Purdue did was declare bankruptcy and say, here's all our money, you figure out how to distribute it. They were truly desperate, I think, to just to get out from under it.
Again, going back to this, because I'm not a lawyer, is there a certain amount of money that bumps it up to like a circuit court, a state court, a federal court? Does that have any play into this at all?
As to the size of an award?
Yeah.
Well, the only limit is that it has to be based on some kind of evidence, and that's the plaintiff's responsibility to provide a cost estimate. Okay. Now, ultimately, the jury decides whether they think, assuming it's a jury trial, the jury decides how much the award should be, and that'll probably be less than what the plaintiffs were asking, but not necessarily. One of the risks, I think, of taking a case to trial is if the jury gets really mad at you, and I would think the drug companies would be a little concerned about that, they may go wild and come up with just a huge award, or they might award punitive damages on top of the compensatory damages. And there are some limits to that, constitutional limits, but still, it could be a great deal of money.
All this money that we're talking about, where does it go? Does it, from the opioid settlement cases, does it typically make its way back into the communities and families that were affected, or does it stay more in government institutions?
Well, it mostly will stay in government institutions. And the interesting question is, what government institution will that be? In the case of Oklahoma, for example, there were Purdue and a couple of other companies reached a settlement with the state, and it was earmarked for mainly to go to universities, Oklahoma State in particular. But within days, the state legislature passed a statute saying you can't do that anymore. It has to go to the state treasury. So there's some tension between whether the money should be restricted to abatement programs and treatment programs, or whether it's just free money to go to the state treasury. That's what happened with the tobacco money. The money was not earmarked in any particular way, and the states just hardly spent anything on helping smokers. They
right.
spent it on all sorts of things. It was just a cookie jar. So, but it would not go, at least directly, in my view, to individuals. Now, of course, they would benefit from any treatment programs that the money was used to develop. But there's no assurance that will happen. State legislatures get to be pretty greedy when they see this huge amount of money rolling around. You can't completely trust them to spend it the way it was intended to be spent.
That just seems kind of crazy to me. This big problem that was created, and now you've got families, generations for that matter now that mm-hmm. are addicted as a result of the unethical practices of some of these companies. Is there anything that as a person living in that state, Oklahoma as an example, could do to sway politicians for that matter to use some of this money for the better purposes of helping people get help?
Well, I think that at least what seems to have happened in Oklahoma, although it remains to be seen whether the legislature will eventually commandeer all the money and spend it on something else, but it was the one of the things that this attorney general did, which was clever on his part, was to characterize this as not a damage claim, but an abatement process. There's a technical difference between a damage claim and the equitable remedy of abatement. And it's a little easier when it's specifically tied to abatement, but they had a plan in place, which I think, or at least they developed a plan during the course of the litigation. So it's a little easier to tie it to the abatement process. Mm-hmm. The same sort of thing happened in California with lead paint. They had an ongoing abatement program to try to clean up the lead paint problem. And when the case was brought, the court just earmarked it for payment into this fund that had already been created. So the politicians didn't get their hands on that money. But if it's just if it's not tied down real very strictly, then anything goes.
You brought up tobacco.
One example. I'm sorry. I was about to say one of the there's a little more sensitivity to this now than there was during the tobacco settlement period, and because there were some really scandalous examples. I think one of the worst was they spent the money on a NASCAR stadium facility instead of helping out smokers.
Oh no.
Yeah, and that did boomerang a little bit, but that's what will happen if people aren't careful.
Well, as we look, you know, more forward into the future with some of these cases that are currently, you know, being tried, how do these cases have any effect on shaping the future of these types of lawsuits? So, you know, how do the cases that have already been settled shape the future of future lawsuits?
Well, I think that they provide some kind of a template, both as to what to do and what not to do. Now, again, I'm not sure how all of this is going to turn out, but if, for example, the class action approach of bringing in all of the people or entities who have not sued, I think that that might provide a model for bringing in having a settlement that involves a large number of potential plaintiffs, and sort of forcing them into the litigation early instead of allowing them to sort of hang around and wait to see what happens. Another thing about that has resulted in some scrutiny is the way this litigation is financed. Most of it, and this goes back to the tobacco litigation and subsequent litigation involving other products, is that plaintiffs' lawyers essentially pay for the court costs and the cost of litigation, and then take a share of the recovery. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a pretty big share because they're taking a huge risk. And these cases are just incredibly expensive to try, because they're so complex. I think that one thing that perhaps we might see out of all of this is that contingency fee arrangements would be either not allowed at all or limited in some way. So you just don't have this situation where the lawyers take on these cases and the government plaintiffs have nothing to lose, you know, mm-hmm. because if they win, they win. If they lose, they don't lose. The lawyers lose. It's just not a very good way to finance litigation of this sort, where it's public interest litigation, not just, you know, two private parties suing.
Yeah. Well, I understand that you've published several books. I'm wondering if there's listeners here on the program to understand what we're talking about a little bit better, if it's one of your books or if it's not, is there some place that you would point them towards to have a better grasp on, you know, how this all kind of plays out?
Well, I guess I should tell you that the books I published were on water law and were published almost 50 years ago, so they're not going to do your readers much good. Of course, I have written a couple of articles, and then there are a number of books on not so much the legal aspect, but on the opioid addiction problem in general. Dreamland is one of them.
That Robert T. Honig.
Dope Sick is another one. And they're nicely written. And there's one that just came out about the experience in West Virginia, the Tug Valley experience. So those are pretty good references. My stuff is pretty legalistic.
Got it.
So I don't know if your readers would they might regret picking it up.
those Dreamland is an especially good book. It talks a lot of
yes, it sure is. They're very well researched, and again, my perspective is more from the legal end of it. Not that I'm not sympathetic to the victims, but you know, lawyers tend to look at things in terms of, well, this claim is no good because of this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And my articles have been mostly along those lines, that I have severe reservations about public nuisance as a theory, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's touted by plaintiff's lawyers, and it was at least successful in the Oklahoma case, and probably will be successful in some of the other ones as well.
Well,
but my sort of interest is more the structural. You know, is this the best way to deal with a problem of this nature?
Got it. Well, I think that there's a lot more to come.
Yeah, and you know, as an example of some of the things that concern me is in the case of the tobacco settlement, for example, the states became essentially shareholders in the tobacco industry because the money is paid out over a long period of time, and if they don't sell cigarettes, the states don't get paid. And the Purdue bankruptcy proposal, which I assume the court will approve of, is somewhat the same way. In other words, they're not going to stop making opioids. They're just going to give the profits to the plaintiffs, the creditors. But that doesn't particularly, obviously there'll be some controls over what they do, but it just, what happens is the government gets involved in and has a stake in the continued existence and success of the industry they're trying to regulate.
Mm-hmm. So a company like Purdue, you mentioned that they declared bankruptcy. Does that mean that they're not making pharmaceuticals now, or they are?
Oh, they are. Yeah. It's a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So they essentially what you do is you being the debtor, and the creditors are the plaintiffs in the case, you say, here's all the money we have, or all of the corporate stock that we have. Mm-hmm. That's all you get. And then we start all over again. However, and this is a result of the asbestos, some of those bankruptcies, what you sometimes get is a sort of a long-term arrangement so that the company remains in business and devotes a certain percentage of its profits to a trust fund, which is used to pay the claimants off over a long period of time.
How long are we talking about, Richard?
I'm sorry, what?
How long are we talking about during these long settlements?
Oh, well, I think the tobacco one was 25 years. I think the Purdue one is indefinitely. In other words, they, and of course, the irony of the Purdue case is they're making opioids and they're also making the medicine to give opioid addicts to, so they're sort of, they're playing both sides of the street or walking both sides of the street. But those things could last, for as long as depending on how they're structured, they could last indefinitely. They're still, asbestos companies are still paying into those funds, and it's been 40 years.
Wow. Okay. Well, this has been a plethora of information today that I think is very, very, it's very thought-provoking, and also I hope will motivate some of our listeners to become more involved in what goes on at these different cases that are being tried, to have a voice in to certainly write or call, you know, some of these, you know, state legislators to let them know their opinions on things.
Well, I think that's right. State attorneys general are also good targets because they're nominally in charge of these cases. And they're elected officials, so they do pay attention input from voters.
I remember Andy Beshear stepping on stage, I think it was last year before he became governor, to talk about, he was at what we call a fed up rally, and it was really all about this. It was about being fed up with the pharmaceuticals industry. So,
well, they have a lot to answer for, and maybe this will generate some better regulation and better oversight, because they'll keep on doing it. As I say, it's the dirty tricks aren't limited to opioids. That just happens to be the one that has come to bite them. But they get sued all the time and pay very large judgments without batting an eye. You know, I mean, multi-billion dollar judgments to the federal government in particular for violating various statutes. And it's just the cost of doing business to them.
Yeah.
But this could be a little different. This could be a wipeout situation for them. Although that, of course, raises another question, and that is, do you really want them put out of business? I mean, who's going to make pharmaceutical products if, you know, it's not like the tobacco situation where, you know, if they'd gone out of business, nobody would have cared except smokers, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But this is a little different. You know, the social value of drugs, pharmaceutical products is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
So you want them, you know, you want to hold them accountable, but you don't necessarily want to put them out of business.
Well, and I think that, I mean, quite frankly, a large part of this money that we're talking about that gets settled upon, I would want to know why a large sum of this isn't put towards education for people who simply do write prescriptions, and then also to the consumers of these particular drugs, what exactly happens, you know, because I think that not being informed as a consumer of these products has quite frankly led to a lot of where we are now.
I think that's right. And you know, one of the things that's happened over the last, say, 20 years or so is that drug companies advertise directly to consumers, sometimes in subtle, backhanded ways. But they, instead of advertising simply or promoting their product simply to physicians, they do an end run around the physicians and try to generate demand on the part of patients. And then the doctors are, you know, between a rock and a hard place. If somebody comes in and said, I want Percocet, or I want whatever it is, it's hard for them to say no.
Well, and then you get accused of being unethical if you don't prescribe it.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the sort of arguments that the opioid manufacturers made. They said, you're not treating pain. People are, you know, in terrible straits because of chronic pain, and you have an obligation to do something about it. And here's the product that will work. And, you know, that argument was pretty persuasive.
Yeah. Well, Richard, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Zach. I enjoyed talking to you, and I hope your listeners got something out of it.
I think that they did. I am Zach Crouch, and you're listening to Landmark Recovery Radio, your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. You can find us online wherever you get your podcasts, and please subscribe to get the most up-to-date information from leading experts. We have guest Joan Arlinghouse joining us on the show today. Joan is an advocate and one of the principals behind Casey's Law in Kentucky. She'll be walking us through how Casey's Law can be filed, how probable cause for treatment is determined, as well as some of the many potential pitfalls filers can face during this process. Joan, this is certainly a topic that I get questions a lot about from family members, so it's great timing on your part to come on the show. Thanks for joining.
Sure. Nice to be here.
So we've talked about Casey's Law on the podcast before, but can you give our listeners a bit of a high-level overview of the law and what it actually does?
Well, Casey's Law is a hopeful option, and we say that because it's not something we ever tell families they need to do. We present this as an option for them to intervene on their loved ones, and it's usually something they're looking for after they've tried everything in their power to help the person. They've either tried to help them, coerce them, you know, encourage them, or possibly their loved one has tried treatment multiple times and just have failed, and possibly because they just didn't stay long enough, you know, for the treatment to work. So Casey's Law provides an option for the families to intervene and have treatment involuntarily, you know, or ordered to involuntary treatment. And it requires a form, a court process. You file a form called 700A. That's the petition that gets filed with the courthouse. It then is required to have two evaluations for families to, you know, try to make sure their loved ones get to. They will be ordered to attend these two evaluations. One is through a qualified mental health professional, and one of them must be a medical doctor. Once those two evaluations are completed, then the respondent and the petitioner appear in court at a predetermined, you know, court date. And at that time, the judge will review the evaluations and all evidence that has been presented and make a determination if they feel the person should be ordered to treatment.
Got it.
That's just the basic process. And it varies a little bit in every county, but that's the overall process.
Thank you for that. And you brought up an interesting concept, especially with the piece around prior to filing cases. Like, you're right, many, many families will exhaust all efforts to get this person into treatment. And I've mentioned this on the program before, but it's so true. Coercion works. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't matter how a person gets into treatment. And in fact, often the best thing for someone to have happen to them is for them to be coerced, so to speak, into treatment, because the statistics and the overall effectiveness of treatment isn't dictated on someone saying, "Hey, I'm going to go to treatment today." You know, it really is once the person gets there and they take advantage of the opportunities that are there, the tools that are provided to them while they're in the experience or episode of treatment, it's really that determines, you know, their success. And, you know, I think that needs to be said, because the reality is, Joan, and you and I probably both are aware of this acutely, that there's really about a 5-hour window of when someone is at their sort of crisis point. And at that point, you know, after 5 hours, the denial, the delusion of a person's thinking who is actively using substances begins to set in again. So if it's Casey's Law, if it's coercion, if it's a family member saying, "You know what, we're just fed up and we're tired and we need you to do something." I think that needs to be said, and really it needs to be, you know, just expressed to our listeners and to anybody.
That's right. And sometimes, you know, we expect people in active addiction to make rational decisions when, because it is That's a brain right. disease, they're not capable of doing that. And sometimes it appears that they're capable because they do make that decision and say, "I need help." And they will think about it, and sometimes they even go, but they don't stay. Or they've missed that window of opportunity right. because there was nothing available to them at that moment, and they weren't able to go. Or they, like we said, they go and they don't stay. But so Casey's Law just provides an option for, you know, trying to make them stay long enough until they realize it is working for them and they need help. Sometimes people just don't even realize they have a problem. That's
right.
just, you know, the disease affects them. They don't even know they need help. So we've had plenty of people, you know, who are in treatment for under Casey's Law and say thank you because they just didn't even realize they needed that help until they've been, you know, until they were in the treatment program for sometimes a few weeks. Sometimes it takes 6 or 8 weeks before they really understand that this is a good place for them.
Has there been any efforts, Joan, on tracking data of those who have gone into treatment through Casey's Law efforts and their, you know, call it success rates, if they've completed the programs, those kinds of things, et cetera?
We do not. And I'm not even sure how much data is out there for any treatment programs on what mm-hmm. they deem as success. I believe some of the facilities track if they completed the program, mm-hmm. but you know, we don't know what happens after they leave. And I don't think a lot of treatment facilities know either, or track anyone that's been in their program. And we have not been able to do that under Casey's Law. Mostly, you know, it would require treatment facilities to be willing to track it. Casey's law is a private matter, so there is, you know, a lot of confidentiality there. So there's not someone who can just ask who all the Casey law recipients are in every county and try to follow up with them on that. Yeah. The AOC does now track how many petitions are filed and how many, you know, how many are granted and how many treatment orders have been, you know, have been granted. But that's the only data we have. But we do know it works. We meet plenty of people, have been to treatment facilities who say, thank you, you know, I'm here under Casey's law. So we know it's being used, and, you know, we get plenty of people who we know it has worked for. We just don't have statistical data.
Well, I'm glad that you're bringing that up, because I think as an industry, you know, as a sector of the mental health industry, addictions treatment, so we're certainly behind in terms of hard data, you know, to track that, because it is difficult. It is hard to keep in contact with people that have left the program, and you really, you know, they move, they change numbers. It's hard to, you know, find out how they're doing. They don't show back up, etc. But I think that we're getting better at that. So I hope that just continues to improve to your points that you've made. I'm curious to know, Joan, as well, about other states that are using similar laws. Have they also found success? I know that Florida has, I believe it's called the Marchman Act.
Correct. We're really not familiar with other states that have anything similar to Casey's law. We do know, I think there's maybe 35 plus states that have some kind of an involuntary treatment act in place, but most of that is for mental health inquests, similar to our 202A for mental health, you know, that Casey's law was kind of modeled after and based on that same statute. But other states do not have something as comprehensive as Casey's law that is there directly for, you know, specifically for addiction to drug and alcohol and other substances that's being used. I believe it was West Virginia or Virginia was going to try to pass one this spring session, and I have not heard whether that, you know, that actually happened or not, but we're not aware of any other states that have something as good as Casey's law.
Gosh, I would hope that a state like West Virginia is able to pass that with the opioid problems that they have.
Right. I think they had a lot of support going into the session, so I haven't heard whether that actually was passed or not. But Charlotte Weddington, Casey's mother, who was the initiator of Casey's law, has been contacted through the years by, you know, people from multiple states asking how they can get such a law in their state. And it requires having a legislator who's willing to, you know, back the bill, who's willing to present that and try to get that passed. And they've just not had a lot of luck with that. It takes, you know, it takes some persistence and perseverance by people fighting for that, and it hasn't happened.
I'm curious to hear from you. Is there a lot of change that are, you know, just can citizens of the state that they're in to maybe call their legislators to just sort of prompt them in passing such laws? Do you think that has an effect?
Yes, that could be very helpful. And if it, you know, of course, the bigger the group that can fight for it and provide evidence of why it would be helpful and, you know, and that it works, the more success they might have. Casey'slaw.org, our website, does have a spot on a place on there where people from other states can try to contact one another if they're willing to put their, you know, put their name and contact information. So if someone else from that state is looking for others in their own state to work with, that information can be found on caseslaw.org. If someone's
appreciate
interested.
That. Joan, going back to what you mentioned at the beginning, I had a question along those lines. The first step of filing is scheduling an evaluator appointment. Does the person who schedules the appointment have to be a relative? And does the evaluator need to actually be a doctor, like an MD?
Well, whoever files the petition, and it does not have to be a relative. It can be it usually is a relative. It's usually a family member is who we see the most, but it can be a friend, and it can be anyone. They do not have to be related. They will file the petition. They actually file in the petition form 700A is the first step. And then it's a good idea to schedule your two evaluations at the same time. But we always encourage people to check with their county, because each county handles the process a little bit differently. So some require you to have those evaluations before you can even file the form 700A, the petition. Some will let you do it after you file the petition. And the reason for that is, once the petition is filed, if a judge, some counties require a separate court hearing to determine probable cause to review the petition, and then some do not. Some just have the judge reviews it and then makes a determination at that point. Once probable cause is determined and that they're moving forward with it, the respondent is served a summons stating that this, you know, petition has been filed and they are required to attend two evaluations. It's helpful when they serve that summons if they can give them the dates and time and place of where those two evaluations are scheduled, and then also the next court date where all this information will be reviewed. So that's why it's kind of done at the same time. It helps the county determine when to set the court date, and then also they can put all of the same information, you know, all of the information in the summons.
That makes sense. You brought up probable cause. Over the time that you've seen these cases go through, recently and, you know, further back, you know, maybe when the law started, what were some common problems that you see, when determining probable cause? Can you give any examples of cases where that's been an issue?
Well, probable cause is determined when the petition is initially filed, and the judge will determine if there's probable cause for proceeding forward with the whole process. And what we have seen is maybe the form 700A is not filled out completely. They may have, you know, not checked appropriate boxes, not provided the correct information. That can halt the process just from the beginning, or if they have not provided enough evidence. And providing the evidence is usually the key factor. Question number three will ask, you know, why you believe the person, you know, would benefit from treatment, why you believe they have a problem and would benefit. And they do not provide very much room on that petition. So we tell people just write the attached and then attach a separate paper explaining all the reasons that they feel they, you know, need to be ordered to treatment involuntarily. And we start with, you know, loss of job, children, their home, previous attempts at treatment that, you know, that they just didn't stay and complete, or they've had, you know, charges, felony charges, even misdemeanors, but they've had involvement with the criminal justice system, their medical history that was related to their substance use, overdoses, the drugs that they've been using, any problems that have been created due to their alcohol and drug use. And the more information they can provide, the better. If they have dates, timelines, you know, they can attach copies of any of their evidence that they have that they are presenting. And so they just need to make sure they completely fill the form completely, answer all the questions, and provide enough evidence.
So I'm curious to hear from you, just let me know, but is it going to be obtuse, so to speak, to the courts if you put in that little reason why it's going to save their life? You know, is that too, you know, is it insensitive to the judges, to the, you know, the court system in general, to just say that? Because, I mean, that's really what we're talking about, isn't it?
Well, question number four will ask if they are a danger to themselves or others, or how they are a danger to themselves or others. And that's where you can fill in. Every time they use, they're a danger to themselves. And it's a good place, you know, to reiterate if they have overdosed or what drugs they're using and how it is endangering their life. And with the drugs we have now, many people, it's not that they're just not functioning in life, but they're dying. So
that's right.
And that's why they're filing the petition. You know, we want them to, one, save their life, and two, give them a life they can live.
That's right. We'll talk about, you know, when they're unable to actually locate the individual, you know, like, I mean, a lot of these folks, you know, they're just on the run. They've hopped around to different people's houses. And, you know, what happens then when, you know, the sheriff or the peace officer is unable to locate the person?
Well, if they cannot locate them to serve the petition, then they really can't move forward, and it'll probably be, you know, it'll be dismissed. We do encourage families, if they don't, if they have no idea where they are, to wait to file until they can locate them or they find out where they are. They can get everything ready to file. And then as soon as they know where they might be or where they can be located, then file the petition. The sheriff or the peace officer, someone does have to be able to serve the summons in order for this to happen. So there's not much we can do when we don't know where they are.
Yeah. And following up on that, is it a matter of really, you know, the sheriff or the peace officer just like if you ask them to come at a certain time, let's just say on a Tuesday at 4 o'clock, because we know that they're going to be there, do they have a much flexibility in their schedule to actually show up, or is it just sort of like they show up when they're ready to?
Well, what we have found is every county is a little different on how they handle it, and also the amount of involvement they're willing to, you know, commit to this process. Mm-hmm. Some counties, the sheriff's department is very helpful in working with families trying to locate them. You know, they'll set it up for, you know, whatever works to try to get this done.
Good. Does the whole process, Joan, start over if you know, no determination is made to order treatment for the respondent?
You mean if they file the petition and it's dismissed?
Yeah. If it's dismissed, as an example, you know, if they can't locate the person, as we just talked about.
Yes, then we would just start over again. And file again if they are not able to find them. Sometimes, you know, depend again on the county, depends on what that court clerk is willing to do or that office is able to do. Some will hold it for, you know, a few weeks, but most will not hold it indefinitely until they find them. So if it's dismissed because they were not able to serve the summons or if probable cause was not found, the process can start over. You'll just have to correct whatever the problem was before you try again.
Got it. And as you well know, there's a lot of people who relapse, and this is a disease where that's fairly common, especially among certain kinds of substances that are being used. Can a person file on a respondent as many times as they like or need to?
Yes, they can. And it has happened. You know, we have people in recovery because they had cases all filed on them, you know, twice. Three times. So as we know, sometimes first attempts don't always work. Sometimes second attempts don't work. But, you know, as long as they're alive and, you know, there's always hope and we keep trying. And yes, they can continue to file on them multiple times.
So follow-up question to that. Is there a time period that has to elapse between each subsequent filing of the cases law?
No, except that the person's previous cases law must be over. As long as that's been dismissed and it's, you know, it's finished, and that can vary. On the petition, you can request up to 60 days of treatment or up to 360 days. So once that period has passed or once the judge has dismissed it, then you start over again.
Talk a little bit about that too. What does 360 days of treatment really mean? What does that include?
Well, it can be a combination usually of inpatient, outpatient, maybe possibly recovery housing, you know, with connection to some kind of support system. It used to be a year of inpatient treatment, and that doesn't really exist too many places anymore. And also, it's not always necessary. So we don't want people to get scared away with that. We don't want the respondents who need treatment to, you know, be afraid that they're going to have to go somewhere for a whole year inpatient. Sometimes that works for people, but we also know that a combination of inpatient, outpatient, you know, there's multiple avenues and any of that can work. And that's up to the evaluators. That is, when the assessments are done by the two evaluations, they are the ones that make a determination or a recommendation for what they think would be helpful for that person. And based on those recommendations is what the judge bases his decision on.
So this is challenging work, right? The field that I'm in, that you are, you know, intimately involved in. I've got a personal, you know, connection because I'm actually in recovery myself, been at it, you know, for quite a while. What got you involved in this? What makes you so passionate around this particular law?
Well, I started a journey with my daughter's addiction back in the very beginning of 2006. Wow. There was, we know, there was just not much information available then for families who were trying to help, you know, mostly parents mm-hmm. trying to help their children. And so we went on for many years with not very good, limited information and not very good information.
Sure.
So after going through the whole journey with her and then finally meeting up with some people in 2013 and 2014, where people started, you know, talking about it in Northern Kentucky. And I was finally able to get some help from others. And I learned a lot. And when my daughter was in recovery, I just felt I had experienced so much and learned so much that I felt I should give back to other families to try to help them so they did not have to experience what I did and hopefully get better help sooner and know what to do.
Well, I know that I appreciate the service that you've given and continue to give to the community because there's a lot of families that would be lost if it weren't for this law. So I appreciate that, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners do as well.
Well, we can thank Charlotte Weddington. You know, she lost her son, Casey, and right. she wanted to give well to keep Casey's memory alive and, again, try to help other families not go through what she did. So, you know, we're grateful that she had the foresight to do that many years ago, and it has been helpful. And it's always nice for Charlotte when she's visiting treatment facilities and meets other people. Casey was her only son, her only child. Mm-hmm. So when she meets others, they're all Casey to her. And it's nice to see, absolutely. You know, people, thanks to the law.
Well, Joan, I just want to say thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate this.
Well, you're welcome. Always glad to, always passionate to talk about this law and find ways to help families intervene.
And this has been real helpful. Listen, if you know someone struggling with an addiction and are searching for answers, visit us at landmarkrecovery.com to learn more about substance abuse programs that are both saving lives and empowering families. And until next week, I'm Zach Crouch with Landmark Recovery Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.